The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Inspiring interviews with today's top landlords. This is the Rental Income Podcast. And now, Dan Lane.
I've got a bonus episode of the podcast for you today. We're going to be talking about how to get a mortgage on a rental property. Most loan officers specialize in doing financing on owner-occupied homes. And there's a lot of differences between getting a mortgage on a house you're going to live in and getting a mortgage on a rental property. So Chaley Ridge is joining us today. She owns a company called Ridge Lending, and her company specializes in making loans on rental properties. So I want to talk to her today about the criteria that lenders are looking at today to get approved for a mortgage. I also want to talk to her about how to get past 10 mortgages. That seems to be a stumbling block for a lot of investors. So we'll talk about that. And I also want to have her go over a case study of how she has helped somebody build a portfolio, someone that started from scratch and in a period of just 2 years bought a bunch of rental properties. So Chaley, I'm excited to have you share your wisdom. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Dan. I am very excited to be here and share whatever wisdom I've earned over the last many years.
Awesome.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Yeah. So where are we today in the market? I know things were really kind of loose in the early 2000s. Then when the market crashed, things got really tight from a lending perspective. Where are we today?
Well, I would say that it's still regarded as a 180 of what we were pre-2008, 2009. But the purse strings have opened up or loosened up rather a little bit. It still tends to be one step forward, two steps back in terms of, you know, what the allowances are, guidelines loosening. A lot of people even still equate the conventional underwriting as walking on water, right? You have to provide your vials of blood and your DNA samples just to get the process started. So it is very different, but, you know, the golden tickets, as we call them conventionally, highest leverage at the lowest interest rates literally on the planet, you know, you have to expect that you got to put a little bit of time and skin in the game.
Sure. Sure.
With that process.
Now, is it still for the golden tickets, the Fannie Freddie loans with the lowest interest rates? Is it still 10 properties for Fannie
yes,
and Freddie?
Sir.
Okay.
Yep. Per qualified individual. So
okay. So a husband and wife could get
yes,
20.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And yep. Then what happens after that? We've got some listeners that have reached their cap and they want to continue to build their portfolio. Like, and things get trickier after those 10 or 20 loans. Like, what do you do at that point?
Well, you're right. The playing field changes just a little bit. But because Ridge Lending specializes in the non-owner occupied space of lending, we have a whole variety or menu of products that applies to those individuals that A, maybe don't fit in the conventional underwriting box, or B, they've exhausted the 10 that they have access to. We move on to specialty. It's called non-QM. And for all intents and purposes, it's very similar to the Fannie Freddie loans. It's a 30-year fixed product. It's the same leverage, 75-80%. All of that is relatively the same, qualification relatively the same. The primary difference is going to be the interest rate. And if that's of interest, I can speak further about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, so where are we today? We're recording this here in May of 2018. So depending on when you're hearing this, this will probably be different. But as of today, where are the rates? Maybe we could talk about the rates for the Fannie and Freddie, the golden tickets, and then compare that to the rates for the specialty product.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, I'd probably want to comment that when we're talking about interest rates, there is a whole variety of variables that will play a role in what the actual rate secured will be. These variables can be things like credit score. The borrower's credit score would play a role. Loan size plays a pretty significant role. The occupancy, right? Difference between owner-occupied and non-owner-occupied, another big adjustment to rate. Loan to value, property type, all of these variables are otherwise included in how the interest rate is going to form. So if we take an average, if I give you the characteristics as follows, let's say it's a single family residence, it's a purchase transaction, $100,000 with 20% down, and a 740 or better credit score, conventionally the individual should expect an interest rate somewhere around 5.375 today.
Okay.
That same set of characteristics on the specialty side is probably closer to 6.75, 6.5 maybe.
Okay. And that's for a 30-year fixed.
Yes, sir.
Right. That's still really good.
Yeah.
That's still really good. Now, what about as far as debt-to-income ratio or like other qualifications that you're looking at when you're making a loan? Like, what's important for people to prepare up front so that when they apply, things go smoothly?
Yeah. So there's a, just a whole slew of moving parts in the underwriting qualifications for conventional or specialty. But the three that are probably most heavily weighted in qualifying are going to be credit score, the assets, and the debt-to-income ratio. Those are the three primary features that we're looking at when qualifying.
And what are some targets that, you know, I guess it's not if you have a, or maybe it is, maybe I should ask this as a question. Is it the kind of thing where if you have a 700 credit score, you're good to go, and if you have a 699 credit score, you can't do anything for them? Or is there a range, or maybe the rates change a little bit depending on your credit score?
Yes and no and yes. So let's start with credit. So,
okay.
And we'll start with conventional. So of the 10 golden tickets, there are two distinct underwriting books, we'll call them, that we have to adhere to when qualifying an individual. The books are applicable. First one is applicable to the loan spots 1 through 6 of the 10. Then there's a second book of qualifications that will apply to those investors that would be purchasing in the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th loan spot. Now, as that describes the credit score part, in loan spots 1 through 6, there's really no minimum, oddly. I mean, I've been able to qualify someone with a 650 credit score and get them a loan because they had compensating factors, maybe low debt-to-income ratio or strong assets. So there's no hard and fast in loan spots 1 through 6 for credit.
Okay.
When we move into the 7 through 10, they raise the qualification bar, and now there is a minimum. It'll be the middle of the three credit scores that the individual has, and it must be 720 or greater to qualify. Now, that's just qualification. If we're talking about interest rates and optimizing that, the optimal is 740 and above to reach, you know, that
okay.
Yeah, that interest rate.
Yep. And then what are you looking for as far as, like, debt-to-income ratio?
The maximum, the threshold is 50%.
Okay.
Of the income that we can extract and prove from the documentation they've sent us.
And then what about for the specialty product? So when you get beyond the 10 golden tickets, like what kind, do they have similar qualifications?
It's very similar. One of the bigger requirements or the bigger adjustments to rate, if we're still kind of talking about that, is going to be the loan size. Minimum loan size on specialty is $75,000. However, loan amounts under $100,000 for specialty take a pretty big hit in rate. Otherwise, the qualifications are going to be very similar to the Fannie Freddie.
Okay. So really the only thing that would stop someone from buying a property is just having the available down payment, because it seems like a 20% down is kind of the minimum.
Yes. Okay. Single family residents actually can leverage to 85%, but there is PMI associated with that loan. The factor is pretty small, though. And then for 2 to 4 unit, they can expect to put 25% down.
Okay. So you're saying that with the 85% leverage, so people could get into a single family with 15% down?
Conventionally, yes.
Conventionally, okay.
Up to the 6th finance property. Beyond that, that goes away, but yeah.
Okay. Now, what about for someone that's self-employed? We have a lot of our listeners that they work in real estate. Maybe they're a realtor or they're a house flipper. How does being self-employed affect getting a mortgage?
Well, that answer is going to get a little bit more complicated. You know, for us self-employed, and I'm in that bucket too, Clearly, we want to use everything that we can to mitigate or reduce the amount of taxes we need to pay. Sometimes, though, we have to choose between qualifying for a mortgage and saving on taxes. One of the things that we are very good at is being able to navigate the battleship in a creek, if that provides an appropriate visual of what goes into the underwriting. With a self-employed tax return, it's going to be very different. There are ways that we can add back in certain things. Depreciation, obviously, is one of them. If they have lots of rental properties, there's other kind of tricks to the trade that we know about within the guidelines that most bankers or lenders wouldn't know to exclude. For example, one-time expenses of repairs or maintenance is something that we get to add back in that helps self-employed people, especially those that have a large Schedule E, which is where the rental properties would be found. But moreover than that, I might just offer the following. A lot of our self-employed people will come to us prior to filing a tax return for the prior year and have us review the draft version first so that we can take that information. We can calculate from that underwriter's perspective what the income will be if they file this way. And then we can report back, you know, some advice, whether it be this looks great, file your tax return. Mr. Smith, maybe filing an extension this year is going to be to your benefit if the qualification piece needs that extra 6 months, right until October 15th. And that's what the extension would give us. Or maybe we need to carry some of the losses forward into the following year. So there's different pieces to that that we can help define for them to optimize qualification.
Coming up on the Rental Income Podcast.
I want to ask about the refining part of the BRRRR strategy. A lot of times that can be a little bit tricky to get done. So we're going to talk about that. I also want to have Jaylee go over a case study of one of her clients that was brand new to real estate investing. They didn't own any rentals, and she helped them finance a rental portfolio that's a pretty substantial portfolio that they put together in just 2 years. We'll get into that in just a second, but first I want to thank our sponsor today. It's Credit Suite. If you're a business owner, whether it's a real estate business or something else, you know how difficult it is to get business credit. Most business credit is tied to your personal Social Security number, and you have to personally guarantee that credit. Well, Credit Suite helps business owners get business credit that's not tied to them personally, that's tied to their EIN. So it doesn't matter about your personal credit quality. It doesn't matter about your business cash flow. It doesn't matter about your collateral. There's no personal guarantee needed. And even when you can't get bank financing, you can get business financing that's tied to your EIN. Credit Suite has helped over 15,000 people build business credit that's linked to their EIN. You might be surprised to know how easy it is for businesses to qualify for business credit. Even startups can qualify. You just need to follow the proper steps to obtain it. And they map out those steps for you in their free guide. You can download it right now at creditsuite.com/rental. That's Credit Suite, creditsuite.com/rental. All right, let's get back to the podcast. So, Jaylee, tell me, is there a difference when you're doing the BRRRR strategy? Sometimes people will buy properties with cash. Sometimes they'll use hard money. Is there a difference when you're refining out to your long-term financing?
Yes, very much so. So if we're, let's focus on conventional. So we're talking about the difference between what is called a delayed refi. This is a Fannie Freddie product, or just a standard cash out refi. And then of course we've got a rate and term. So let's start with the delayed refi. That seems to be the most common when we're talking about the BRRRR strategy, where the individual had paid cash for the property, in which case there is no seasoning requirement before we can use the ARV or that appraised value at 75% max to regain whatever capital they've got in that. One important thing about that, Dan, I'd like to mention, the rule for delayed refi states that the borrower is eligible to get back a maximum of what the HUD lists as their acquisition cost. So if they have rehab or renovation dollars that are going to be involved with this, along with the purchase price, the total amount must be listed on that HUD in order for them to get up to that much back.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Wait, so I guess, like, maybe to put it into an example, so if you buy a property for $50,000 and you're going to put $25,000 into fixing the property up, are you limited to getting back the $50,000 acquisition cost, or could you also get back the $25,000 that you've spent to fix the property up?
As long as both the 50 and 25, the full 75 is listed on that HUD,
okay,
you are eligible to get both. If just the 50 is on there, the 50 is all they can get back. Now, that gets a little bit more complicated. Most of the turnkeys out there are aware of this, and they get the both amounts, the total amount on that HUD. So it's usually fine, but yeah, the rule says the maximum is
okay,
what number is on there.
Right.
What's happening there, obviously, is let's say the $25,000 is going to the GC, the general contractor, prior to them beginning the work. So there may be a little bit of uneasiness, but the turnkeys have those relationships. And, you know,
okay,
remember that the GCs are bonded and insured. I've not seen it be an issue.
Okay. Okay.
But,
okay,
yeah,
awesome. And so as far as cash versus hard money, is there,
yes,
a difference at all? In
So, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So if we're talking about doing a cash out and the individual has used hard money to acquire the property, in that scenario, they must have 6 months ownership seasoning before I can use the appraised value, the ARV, to refinance the property.
Okay.
If it's just a rate and term, right, they're not expecting any cash back, right, they just want to pay off the lien of the hard money, then we don't need that 6 month seasoning. I can go off the appraised value
on
a rate and term immediately. Yeah.
Okay. That's good. That's good. All right. Well, let's talk about a case study of a client that you have helped. So what can you tell us about this client and where they were before they started working with you?
So the case study that I chose for this is a couple. They were both dentists, and they'd spent a long time building up their practice, and they hadn't really spent much of that time figuring out how their retirement was going to play unless they just worked forever. They got into, or they started looking, they had their 401ks and their different retirement plans that way. But they started to look a little bit closer at real estate. And over the course of about 2 years between the two of them, they now own 36 properties. One
Wow.
of the things that I wanted to share with the listeners in how we were able to accomplish that in such a small period of time. Now, obviously, they had the capital, right? Mm-hmm. They had the finances to go ahead and be able to do that. But to strategize with not only the turnkeys and the groups that they were working with around the country, but how we fit in, and what I think is really important, is the education of the financing piece to all of this. Because if you don't know what you don't know, it really can get away from you. I feel like the learning curve in real estate is exceptional. I think a lot of people would agree to that.
Sure.
And you throw the financing part on top of it, and I always say that I kind of expect that exponentially increases that learning curve. So what we were able to do together is I was able to take them through a pretty rigorous pre-qualification process. I was able to understand pretty clearly what their short and long-term goals were. And then we kind of set up a plan going forward that was fluid, right? That was subject to change as goals and, mm-hmm. and things changed. But I was able to educate them on teaching them how to optimize the debt to income ratio, how to keep that credit score at that optimal 740 and above. And then assets, obviously, too, between the two of them, the reserve requirements and the liquid funds sourced and seasoned. All of those details were important. And we spent a significant amount of time going through all of that so that they understood it. And not that they needed to be experts in the financing side, but I think it gave them a level of comfort, and it also allowed them the opportunity to accomplish their goals in such a quick period of time. So they are now, let's see, I had this written down and I left the notes in my car, but collectively the passive income that they have gained is just a little bit over, I think, $12,000 a month.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. And what period of time was this in again?
It was just, I think, just over 2 years.
2 years. Okay. And did they buy a lot of properties all at once when they were getting started out? Or like, was it pretty even that they bought all 36 properties over that 2 year period?
I would say, well, I wouldn't say it was random, but I would say that it was, they would buy two or three at a time, and then another month would go by and another two or three, maybe more. Okay. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Okay. And did they do 20% down for every property?
They did. Yeah. Okay. Or the ones that they had, they bought a few 2 to 4 units, and that requires 25% okay. down. But yes.
And were they all in one market, or were they in a couple of different markets?
Good question. Several different markets, okay. actually. And that's one of the things that we discussed when we were strategizing is the diversification, not just in market, because that's important, but in property type, right? Having a good balance of single family versus the 2 to 4. And then the other thing, if I can just take a second and comment, mm-hmm. you know, cash flow versus appreciation. I feel like after the crash, right, appreciation, mm-hmm. I think, took a bad rap. In some circles, it's considered a dirty word. But I think that to discount it in this real estate cycle where cash flow is king, I mean, that's just the predominant focus. I feel like the appreciation is sort of rejected. And I think that's short-sighted. I think there needs to be a little bit of a diversification there as well, so long as the property cash flows, of course.
Right.
But you probably, and I'm sure you've spoken about this, Dan, the higher the cash flow in a market, the lower the appreciation and vice versa, right? It happens that way.
Totally.
So the markets, going back to your original point, the markets that they purchased in, there was a good diversity there. So 80%, I would say, of their 36 were for cash flow, and 20%, they purchased properties that had the potential appreciation, longer term play, still cash flowed, but just not as much as the other portion of their portfolio.
Now, did it get easier or harder to get the approvals as they were getting more properties? Because their cash flow is going up, but they've got more mortgages on their credit report at the same time. So what was that like?
Well, because we really understand the mechanics of all this, it actually became easier. Initially, just because you're getting started, you really don't know what you're doing for new investors. I think that took some getting used to for them. They were learning about the real estate and property management and the finance. I think over time it ended up getting easier. And then for us as the lender, it became easier too, because we knew the clients, qualifications so well, mm-hmm. and knowing how to guide them about, acquisition year rental income formula versus Schedule E formula and positioning them appropriately in any given year made it easy because we'd been with them from the beginning.
Right.
So I would say it kind of got easier. Okay. I know that sounds kind of hard to believe.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It does. And do you remember the price range that their properties were in?
I think it was a pretty wide, overall, I would say the majority of their portfolio was in that 80 to 150 range. Okay. They had a few fourplexes that were, you know, 300,000 to 400,000. Mm-hmm. But overall, I would say, yeah, single family, 80 to 120, 150.
And were they all like 1% deals for the most part, or were they?
Most part or higher.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's great. I mean, so a $12,000 positive cash flow built over 2 years. That is really, really awesome. Well, great job.
They were aggressive. Yeah. They were super aggressive. And now we're looking at, you know, accelerating some of the payoff. We're looking at amortization tables and seeing which of those properties maybe they want to attack with the, because they don't need the cash flow yet. Right.
Right.
They may be attacking some of the smaller mortgages, higher interest rates, and getting those paid off. And as you can guess, the amortization of that really snowballs.
Oh,
so
my God,
if they wanted to, right, in pretty short order, they could have those 36 mortgages paid.
Right. So if they didn't have mortgages, like, do you know what their total cash flow would be if everything
was
paid off?
That's a great question. Yeah, I would say that it's probably upwards of 30 plus thousand, 35,000.
Wow. That is a great retirement. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, if someone is interested in talking to you more about how they can finance rental properties, what's the best way for someone to reach out to you?
Well, they can certainly go to our website and check us out there. There's an intake form if they are interested in looking at our Getting Started package for pre-qualification. They could call us toll free at 855-747-RIDGE. Or 74 Ridge, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, 747-4343. Or they can email info@ridgelandinggroup.com.
Awesome. Well, I will go ahead and put links to everything on the website. You can find it at rentalincomepodcast.com/ridge. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, Dan. Thank you for having me.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.